Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo bensa shujya monifo. Okay, first I would just like to say a few words about the structure of the course. The course, as you know, will be focusing upon the Majjhima Nikaya, which is the middle-length discourses of the Buddha, though occasionally we will take some suttas from some of the other sources which help to show, to shed light on the topic that we'll be dealing with. And I've arranged the suttas that we will study in a particular deliberate sequence. If you're familiar with the Majjhima Nikaya, then you know that the suttas there are arranged without any clear, intelligible sequence, but almost they're arranged just by way of certain chance words that occur in the suttas themselves. But I've tried to structure the course to follow what is called the gradual exposition of the Dhamma, which the Buddha often followed when he gave discourses. But I begin with a series of suttas which will help to illuminate the nature of the Buddha's own experience, which is called Sammasambodhi, supreme enlightenment or supreme awakening. Now I have here 6 suttas. In the Majjhima Nikaya, we will begin with the Arya Pariyasana Sutta number 26. But I won't take that straight through from beginning to end, because this sutta continues beyond the Buddha's enlightenment to his decision to teach and his first exposition of the Dhamma. I will cover all of that, but we sort of interrupt the sutta halfway and then go back, because the Arya Pariyasana Sutta treats the actual enlightenment experience of the Buddha very briefly, very concisely. So then I want to step back and then take some other suttas which shed more light on the Buddha's enlightenment, more light on enlightenment, but which show that experience from different angles and in somewhat greater detail. So then we take, while we're still in the midst of Majjhima number 26, we take the sutta called Bhayabhairava Sutta. But in that sutta, it's only a few pages. You could read the whole thing. But I'm going to focus on sections or paragraphs 21 to 33. The other sections you read, but I don't have to discuss. I think that they're quite evident. Then we'll take sutta number 36, the Mahasatika Sutta. Again, it's not going to hurt you to read the whole thing. It's just a few more pages than I'll actually discuss. But what we'll focus on are paragraphs 12 to 44. And then from Majjhima Nikaya number 12, the Mahasihanada Sutta, this I won't discuss, but it has a section, or quite a long section, which describes in detail the various ascetic practices that the Buddha undertook during his quest for enlightenment. So to get a fuller, more detailed look at the Buddha's period of striving, of his struggle for enlightenment, you should read paragraphs number 44 to 61. Then the next two suttas in this section, one will come from the Samyutta Nikaya. This I will have to make photocopies and hand out. And then from the Digha Nikaya, it's really only one paragraph. I might not even make photocopies, but might just read it out loud in class, because just it has a few sentences which shed greater light upon a passage treated rather concisely in the other suttas. Then in the sequence of the course, we'll come to a number of suttas which deal with how to approach the Dhamma. That is, when we're coming to the Dhamma out of the blue, how do we go about adopting the right way to enter into the Dhamma without throwing ourselves into it through blind faith or remaining aloof by just treating it as a subject of intellectual entertainment. Then from sections 3 on through section 7, we build up gradually from the simpler stages of the path, the ethical life, all the ways up to the attainment of wisdom and final realization. Then in section 8, we'll deal with some passages from a sutta that discuss the nature of the Buddha's own qualities. And then in section 9, we'll take a look at some suttas which deal with life in the Sangha, in the Buddhist community. And I expect that the whole series of talks will take something like 2 years. So we have to be patient and go gradually deeper and deeper. Okay, now I first would like to explain something about the organization of the Buddhist canon itself. And I should mention that I don't want these talks to be considered very formal lectures, like I'm a person of authority sitting up here giving the ultimate pronouncements about the nature of Buddhism or the Buddha's teaching, like the Pope making pronouncements. But more, I will give a little talk. We will examine the suttas together. When there are questions that come up, please always feel free to ask. Even in the midst of my talk, if something is unclear, just feel welcome to put up your hand if you need clarification. Okay, to see where the Majjhima Nikaya fits into the structure of the Buddha's discourses. Can the people in the back hear me? Within the Pali Canon, the Pali Canon is the collection of texts of Theravada Buddhism, Southern School of Buddhism. We have all the texts, canonical texts, collected into what is called the Tipitaka, which means literally three baskets, or three compilations. One is the Vinaya Pitaka, the compilation concerned with discipline. And this is the collection which contains the rules and regulations for the Buddhist monastic order. Okay, please come. Then we have the Sutta Pitaka, which is the collection of the Buddha's discourses, as well as discourses by some of his more prominent disciples, also records of the Buddha's conversations, discussions with people from the different strata of Indian society in his day. And then we have, I'm going to leave a blank space there, a third collection of philosophical treatises called the Abhidhamma Pitaka. The Abhidhamma Pitaka contains seven treatises which treat the Buddha's teachings in a very detailed, systematic, and technical form. It's quite evident that the Abhidhamma Pitaka is a compilation which originated perhaps several hundred years after the passing of the Buddha, but it came to be included within the Buddhist canonical texts by about, perhaps by 300 years after his passing. Okay, the section of the Buddha scriptures of greatest interest to modern readers is the Sutta Pitaka. And this compilation is organized into five divisions called Nikayas. The word Nikaya, we could translate collection.
Okay, the Digha Nikaya means literally the collection of long discourses. The Majjhima Nikaya, collection of middle-sized or middle-length discourses. Then the Samyutta Nikaya, the word Samyutta means connected or grouped together. And this is a collection of short discourses in which the chapters collect together many, many short discourses dealing with a common topic. For example, many of the short discourses dealing with the teaching of dependent origination come together in one chapter. Many short discourses dealing with the five aggregates, with the six sense bases, with the elements, with the factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. So this is a very systematic and orderly collection. The fourth collection is a seems to be a very unsystematic and disorderly collection, almost a chaotic collection. Because here the governing principle is to take the short discourses that don't fit into the Samyutta Nikaya and arrange them. You see, when the Buddha spoke to make it easy for his listeners to remember his sermons, he would often structure his sermon around a numerical theme. So sometimes he would say, there is one thing that you should remember, one thing you should develop. So then other times he would say there are two things to practice, two things to abandon, two things lead to well-being and happiness. Then there are suttas dealing with three things, four things. So the Anguttara Nikaya collects all of the suttas that are organized around a numerical scheme. And it arranges them into 11 sections, the book of ones, the book of twos, the book of threes, up to the book of elevens. Then the fifth collection is, sometimes it's called the minor collection, but it's actually a very, very big collection of short works of a rather miscellaneous nature. It includes, for example, works like Dhammapada, a very famous work, the Dhammapada, Sutta Nipata, the verses of the elder monks and nuns, the Theragata, Therigata, and so on, altogether. And also it contains the famous Jataka stories, which are the stories relating to the Buddha's first former births. And now, even though it seems that the first two collections are organized according to length, but actually there seems to be some difference in their purpose. And this, when I explain this, you'll see why I chose the Majjhima Nikaya. It seems to me, this is my observation, that the Digha Nikaya, the suttas, these suttas are aimed primarily at members of the non-Buddhist section of Indian society at the time of the Buddha, maybe a century or so afterwards. And so they deal largely with topics that would have been a vital concern to people living in society at that time. The claims of the Brahmins to superiority. Suttas which try to demonstrate the superiority of the Buddha to the other religious teachers of the period. Suttas which show the Buddha as being a more powerful figure than the deities worshipped by the Indian people of that period. So these suttas are, with a few exceptions, are of less interest to us today than those in the Majjhima Nikaya. It seems that the suttas of the Majjhima Nikaya were intended primarily for those who have already entered into the fold of the Dhamma and are concerned principally with the philosophical principles of the Buddha's teachings and the practical training that the Buddha has devised for his followers. Now, although these texts, this particular collection, belongs to the Theravada or Southern school of Buddhism, these texts have counterparts in the Northern school of Buddhism, where they are called agamas. Agama, the word agama means something like a transmission or a heritage. And so in the Northern Buddhist tradition, they use Sanskrit, so the word is a little bit different. And these collections have been translated into Chinese and are preserved in the Chinese Tripitaka. And there's a very close resemblance between the text and the two collections. Not exact correspondence, but the resemblance is quite close, particularly in regard to the first three Nikayas and the first three Agamas. And this is fairly reliable evidence for the antiquity of these texts, which shows that they came down from a period before early Buddhism started to splinter into different schools. I want to speak a little bit about how the texts came to be collected. In this today's lecture, I'm giving more background to the suttas rather than discussion of the suttas themselves. Perhaps if we have time, we'll start on the first sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya. I'll try to focus on the background now. Okay, it's important to understand that during the time of the Buddha and for 400 or so years afterwards, religious texts were not written down, but they were learned orally from a teacher. The student had the task of preserving the text in memory, and those who became learned, prominent teachers in their own right had the responsibility of transmitting the teachings that they had heard to their pupils. And so within the monastic order, there were groups of monks who had very highly trained memories, and they would specialize in learning the suttas and preserving them by memory. The Buddha's own personal attendant, the monk named Venerable Ananda, had a memory, a capacity for memory, which would probably put most tape recorders and even compact discs to shame. It said that he could remember some 84,000 discourses of the Buddha quite perfectly. Now, in the earliest period, the texts were not yet organized into the system of pitakas, nikayas, but there was a different scheme of organization, which called the nine types of teaching. Then after the Buddha's parinirvana, after the Buddha's passing away at the age of 80, his disciples realized that it was very important in order for the Dhamma, the teaching, to last for a long time in the future, it was important to collect the texts and preserve them for future generations. The Buddha passed away in the town of Kushinara here, which was a small and insignificant town.
But at the time, the most prominent city in northeastern India was the city of Rajagaha, or Rajgir, located here. And so after the Buddha passed away, 500 of his liberated disciples, disciples who were arahants, met in council in Rajgir to collect the teachings. And the account of this first council that's given in the late chapter of the Vinaya Pitaka itself. And in this very early phase of the teaching, the teachings were organized into only two collections. The Vinaya collection, the collection of rules and regulations for the monastic order, and the sutras, the Buddha's discourses. At this point, the Abhidharma Pitaka is not mentioned in the Pali canon. In the Pali Canon's account of the First Council. So that seems to be fairly solid evidence that the Abhidhamma Pitaka arose later. At this first meeting, according to the account in the Pali Canon, the text had been organized into the four Nikayas the way we have them today. But this is probably what we call an anachronism, something which has been projected back into the past. But the organization into the Nikayas would have come perhaps some generations later. But once the texts were organized into the form of the Nikayas, then special companies were created, which were given the task of each company the task of memorizing a particular Nikaya and selecting pupils and training the pupils to preserve these texts by memory so that they could in turn transmit them to their own pupils in time. These groups of reciters, these are called bhanakas. So we have, for example, diga bhanakas. These would be monks who would specialize in memorizing the diga nikaya. There would be majjhima bhanakas, those who would specialize in memorizing the majjhima nikaya, and so on. And in this way, the teachings had been preserved for about 400 years, even when the Dharma spread from India to Sri Lanka about the 3rd century BC. When it came to Sri Lanka, in Sri Lanka too, groups of reciters were formed who would take upon themselves the task of preserving the texts and transmitting them by oral recitation. And this happened until in the first century BC, there was a terrible famine came to Sri Lanka. And many, many people died and many, many monks died. And there was one text, it said, that was preserved by only one reciter. There was only one reciter who survived for that particular text. And for this reason, the monks met in council and they decided that the Dhamma is in danger, and if it's going to survive, it will be necessary to write the text down. And so in the 1st century BC, a group, and also at that time there came to power a king who seemed to be somewhat hostile to the monks. And I think they felt that if they were threatened by the king, then the Dhamma could be endangered. And so they met in council away from the royal capital, and they wrote the text down on ola leaf strips, using a stylus to cut the text. And from then on, more and more copies were made until the texts were transmitted in written form. But even then, there would still be many, many monks who would practice in order to deepen their knowledge of the text, to preserve, to impress the text or the Dhamma upon their own mind. They would devote their time, a lot of their time, to memorizing the suttas anyway. So, for example, even today, this practice is kept very much alive. Well, I have to say it's faded out a great deal in Sri Lanka, but in Burma, it's kept alive. And in recent times, there have been Burmese monks who know the entire Tripitaka, all three collections of some 41 volumes by memory. So that if you take any sutta and you start reading a few sentences from it, once they know what you're reading from, they'll be able to pick up at that point and then continue and complete the text. That's the way they test them in Burma. And even in Sri Lanka in the 20th century, early 20th century, there were many monks who would memorize large numbers of texts. My own ordination teacher had memorized several volumes of the scriptures. And when he was learning English, the way he would learn English, people would send him translations from the sutta collections, an English translation, and he would just memorize them. And in this way, he would get familiar with English vocabulary and English grammar. Okay, and now to give some background to the understanding of the text. Of course, the Dhamma itself, it's a timeless teaching in that it's always applicable, always relevant to the human condition. But still, Buddhism as a historical phenomena has arisen under certain historical conditions. And so I want to just give a background of some of the political, social, economic developments which lie behind the appearance of the Buddha on the human scene. The dates of the Buddha are somewhat in dispute. There are two chronologies which are recognized by scholars. I'm not in a position to judge between them. One puts the Buddha's dates at something like 566 BC to 486 BC. The other puts the Buddha's date somewhat later, perhaps 500 BC to 420 BC, even 480 BC to 400 BC. But the time of the Buddha was a period of great transformations taking place in many different dimensions of human life. First, politically, at the time of the Buddha, the dominant political system had been small republics, which were usually, they were not democratic republics, but they were generally dominated by a wealthy aristocracy. But at the time the Buddha was born, the old system of the tribal republics was starting to collapse, and the republics were joining together and consolidating into monarchies. Monarchies which would have been anxious to expand and to swallow up the tribal republics. When we read the traditional accounts of the life of the Buddha, we're told that the Buddha was the son of a powerful king in northern India. In fact, that's not true. He was the son of what seemed to be a chieftain in a tribal, small tribal republic in the Himalayan foothills. This tribal republic was the Sakyan Republic, which was in a state of dependency and subordination to one of the more powerful upcoming kingdoms, the kingdom of Kosala. So the two powerful kingdoms at the time of the Buddha the kingdoms which were beginning to expand and swallow up more and more territory. One was the kingdom of Magadha, located in this region here. And it was within the kingdom of Magadha that the Buddha had one of his main centers, the famous bamboo grove in Rajagaha or Rajgir. The other major kingdom was the kingdom of Kosala to the northwest. Kosala was here. And its capital was the city of Shravasti or Savati. And the Buddha's own home state, the Shakyan Republic, which had its capital at Kapilavastu, was in a state of, it was subordinate to the kingdom of Kosala, a tributary to the kingdom of Kosala. And because when kingdoms arise, it's quite natural that kings are never satisfied with any limits to their territory, but want to devour any other state which threatens them. So a rivalry had been erupting between the kingdom of Magadha and the kingdom of Kosala, which led during the Buddha's own lifetime to wars between these two kingdoms. Eventually, over the centuries after the Buddha's death, the kingdom of Kosala lost its power and the kingdom of Magadha increased in power until it became the center of the first Indian Empire under the rule of King Ashoka, famous King Ashoka. Okay, in the period leading up to the appearance of the Buddha, the birth of the Buddha, there were also changes taking place in the economy. There was a tremendous expansion of the economy and a shift in the focus of the economy from cattle rearing to agriculture. This is very important. Probably it was the invention of iron which accelerated the expansion of agriculture. And once agriculture, this was a rice-based economy, once agriculture expanded, it led to the production of a surplus of grain. The surplus of grain and of other foodstuffs facilitated the growth of cities. And so what is characteristic of this period is increasing urbanization. With the increase of cities, there emerged currency, a money-based economy. Having a money-based economy facilitated the growth of trade. And so as trade increased, then market towns began to arise. Between the major cities, market towns appeared, and then trade routes were created, connecting the major cities and running through the market towns. Or actually, the market towns would have arisen along the trade routes. And this rise of the or expansion of the economy, the increase in urbanization, the growth of trade, made possible the rise to prominence of a mercantile class, a class of merchants, businessmen, bankers, who often allied themselves with the kings and provided financial assistance to the kings, sponsoring their own
projects of internal development and external expansion. Particularly, they would have made possible the money from the mercantile class, would have made possible the growth of armies and the creation of more weapons. Now, in the earlier phase of Indian society, before these developments took place, under the dominance of the class religious specialists called the Brahmins, society had been structured for those areas under the domination of the Brahmins. Society had been structured into four basic social classes, four primary social classes. These are sometimes called castes, but in this early period, I think the word caste is not fully applicable, but we call them four basic social groups, social classes. The Brahmins were the religious specialists who preserved the sacred texts of Brahmanism called the Vedas. They performed the rituals, the sacrifices, and they gave religious advice to the kings. They often served as advisors and ministers to the kings. And the kings regarded success in their own enterprises as largely dependent upon supporting the Brahmins. The Kshatriyas were the warriors and the administrative class. The Vaishyas were the agriculturists, the cultivators, and the Shudras were the workers, the laborers, serfs, peasants. But in the time of the Buddha, or shortly before the Buddha was born, this class system was beginning to lose its meaning. Of course, the Brahmins continued to perform their own religious functions and tried more and more aggressively to gain control of the whole system. The Kshatriyas maintained their own administrative and political functions, but people in the other classes, particularly the Vaishyas, who were originally cultivators, small businessmen, were now becoming more and more powerful in society because they were the ones who became the business people, the merchants. They accumulated the wealth, and so they came to have a stronger and stronger voice in national, in political affairs. And now because the society, the economy, was able to turn out a surplus of foodstuffs, it was able to support a class of non-productive people who devoted themselves to the religious life. And within the religious community, there were two basic groups. One of the Brahmins, who I just mentioned, and the other, which was a new class, which became more and more prominent in the period just before the appearance of the Buddha, were called the Shramanas. In Sanskrit, Shramanas, or in Pali, Samanas. So we have these two religious groups. The Brahmins were the powerful, entrenched religious group from ancient times, who were dominating Indian society from perhaps as far back as 2000 BC. And their religion centered upon recognizing the text called the Vedas as the supreme religious authority, divinely revealed religious texts. The religion of the Vedas centered on the performance of rituals, particularly sacrifices, as essential for success in life. And the religious aim which lay behind the performance of these rituals and sacrifices was material prosperity in this world and a rebirth in a heavenly world. And within the Brahminic scheme, rituals governed all the major events in the life of human beings. From the time of birth, when a child is born, the Brahmins have to be called in to perform the rituals and given certain payment for the ritual of birth. At the time of marriage, or at the time when the young man, a young person becomes a young man, then he is given a rite of initiation into manhood, and it's the Brahmin who performs that rite. All the ways through life, marriage rituals, even especially where the person dies, it's the Brahmins who perform the funeral rituals. And kings and other rulers were regarded as dependent upon the services of the Brahmins to perform the rituals that would ensure the prosperity of their kingdoms and their success in, particularly in warfare. And the kings would have to pay the Brahmins very handsomely for these services. The Brahmins were householders. That is, they lived household lives, they married, they begat children, and they regarded the upholding of the family tradition as being absolutely essential for the health and stability of society. The Brahmins did not have a strong belief in a continuous series of rebirths, it seems. At least the Vedas do not really propose the idea of rebirth very clearly. But rather, the Brahmins upheld as the supreme religious goal a rebirth in heaven, and particularly rebirth in the company of the great God who is called Brahma. The Brahmins believed that Brahma, the supreme God, had created the universe, had created the social system with themselves as the dominant social class, and with each of the other social classes intended to be subordinate and dependent upon the Brahmins. In contrast to the Brahmins, the other type of religious figure, the Shramanas, were ascetics or renunciants. They left behind the family life, the household life. They entered upon a homeless life of renunciation, a life of continual wandering without any fixed abode, except usually during the rainy season, 3 or 4 months of the rainy season, when travel became difficult. They would have to settle in a fixed residence with some shelter, but as soon as the rain stopped, they would resume their wandering. And the purpose of the Shramanas in adopting this lifestyle was to seek liberation from the round of rebirths. The Shramana culture was rooted in a belief that all living beings exist in this cycle of continuous, uninterrupted birth and death. and that the supreme goal of a spiritual seeker is to break the fetters that keep us to this cycle of birth and death and to gain spiritual liberation. For most of the Shramana groups, liberation is to be achieved through undertaking ascetic practices, particularly self-mortification. It's the body with its desires that keeps the soul or spirit in bondage. And so to break the grip of desire and attachment, the spiritual seeker has to afflict himself with torments, with suffering, with bodily mortification, so that the soul or spirit, like a bird, is able to break out of its cage and fly freely to the state of liberation. Some of the ascetic groups believe that the key to liberation was attaining a special type of knowledge or a special meditative state, a higher meditative state. And the followers of the ascetic practices would often they would meet in different lodges which were set up especially for the wandering ascetics, and they would often engage in philosophical debates in which they would dispute their ideas. And those teachers who were especially convincing, especially prominent, would defeat their opponents in debate and win over their rivals along with their following. And this way, some of the ascetic groups became quite prominent. Before the arising of the Buddha, one of the most prominent ascetic groups is still in existence today. They are called the Jains. And so we have still in India, Jainism, the descendant from this very ancient spiritual community, predating even the Buddha himself. And what is very significant about the culture of this period is that the ascetics did not undertake any labor to earn money or to purchase their own food or grow their own food, but they existed or lived in dependence upon the lay communities. And it was common, a kind of common knowledge or common understanding amongst the people in India in this period that they had a spiritual obligation to support the wandering ascetics by providing them with their very simple requirements. Basically, the ascetics would wander silently with their alms bowls, and people would offer them food, sometimes medicines, cloth. And very occasionally, some dwelling for the rainy season. And it was part of the worldview of this period that by offering sustenance, support to the wandering ascetics, lay people could acquire spiritual merit which would help them in their own progress through the round of rebirth. And it was against this background that the Buddha came into the world, and as we will see when we start on our sutta next time, that the Buddha became a member of the Shramana class of religious wanderers when he entered upon his own quest for enlightenment, and in time he became the greatest teacher in the Shramana community. Okay, maybe this should do for introductory talk. If there are any questions, any comments, please feel free to make them.
to deal with the historical background. Okay, one book that I could recommend, it deals more with the relation of the Buddha's teaching to the Brahminic teaching. Okay, it's called by Richard Gombrich, called How Buddhism Began. Another book that I relied on for this information is by Uma Chakravarti. It's called The Social Dimensions of Early Buddhism. It's published by Multil Banasidas. Then there's another book, it's by a German scholar, it's translated into English, by Wolfgang Schumann, called The Historical Buddha. Then another book is by Rupert Gaten, called The Foundations of Buddhism. Another book, Michael Caritas, it's simply called The Buddha. Yeah. Yeah.
You mentioned one person. The first one was by one person. Can you just give me the name?
Who
on the first time?
It's more than one person. There are several different scholars have different dates. Most scholars used to accept the older date, 566 to 486. But I think Richard Gombrich he's a very prominent British scholar. He favors the more recent date. Gombrich. I think it was a German scholar who first accepted that particular dating. Was it Waldschmidt, I think? Ernst Waldschmidt. Also one finds, I think, yeah, also perhaps a source for these two dates. It's in Etienne Lamotte, History of Indian Buddhism. So I think maybe Lamotte just accepts the older date. Okay.
Shraman.
Not very well. That's a good question. The Brahmins were very critical of the Shramanas because for the Brahmins it was very important to maintain the family tradition, family lineage, the household life. And so they would sometimes speak very abusively of the Shramanas, call them these bald-headed, they use the term shram in Pali, samanaka. It's like, maybe you could call them shaveling ascetics, these ascetic shavelings, or bald pates, you would say. So they were very critical. And we see even in the Buddhist scriptures, the Buddhist texts, sometimes when the Buddha would meet the Brahmins would begin, when they first meet the Buddha, they speak sometimes quite abusively to him. They use ways of speaking of the Buddha which are sort of intended to put him down. And the ascetics were quite, the shramanas were very critical of the Brahmins. They depict the Brahmins as being luxurious, greedy, proud, arrogant, supercilious, very worldly, fond of milking the kings and wealthy merchants for their money by convincing them that they need to have rituals and sacrifices performed. And so the two groups were at loggerheads with each other. But there were some Brahmins who, and we see in the texts, sometimes they would come to the Buddha with a rather aggressive and antagonistic attitude, and then they would speak abusively to the Buddha, and the Buddha would speak to them politely, engage them in discussion, And by the time the discussion is finished, then they become convinced of the Buddha's, the value of the Buddha's teaching. And it's quite interesting to note that actually this Uma Chakravarti, who did the social dimension of Buddhism, she has some tables in the back of her book in which she tries to find the class identity of those disciples of the Buddha who are mentioned in, whose class identity is given within the Buddha's texts. And she found that the greatest number of them are from the Brahmin caste. Even the Buddha's chief disciples, Sariputta and Mahamoggallana, were Brahmins. Mahakasapa was a Brahmin. Mahakachayana was a Brahmin.
So the Chalas would have predated the Buddha by how many years? Or what was the time period of the conception of that?
Exactly when the Shramanas began, it's not really known, because the earliest texts that we have are probably the Buddhist texts, the Jain texts, but there seem to be some hints, even in the Vedic texts, that at that time, even at the time the Vedas were compiled, that there were a type of wandering ascetics who would resort to solitary places in the forest and engage in ascetic practices. This could have been like we call them the pregenitors. We call them the pregenitors of the Shramanas. Very early form, the ancestors of the Shramana class. They could even go back. This is a theory which has been developed by some historians of India, that there was, you see, the Brahmins came into India. They were not the original inhabitants of India, but there was an older civilization in India predating the arrival of the Aryans, who came from the Central Asian plains through the Hindu Kush mountains into the Indus Valley and then spread out over northern India and subdued the original inhabitants, who were people of the Dravidian race, and they were pushed down to the south and became the Dravidian people of South India. Now, there was a speculation that the original inhabitants of India had the belief in a soul which transmigrates from life to life, whereas the Brahmins in their earliest phase, as indicated in the Vedas, did not have the idea of a soul which transmigrates from life to life. And the old inhabitants of India might have also had yogic practices and ascetic practices aimed at liberation. And it's possible that these ideas, when the original inhabitants were suppressed and subdued by the Brahmins, that these ideas remained as a kind of undercurrent which in time penetrated the thinking of the Brahmins themselves, and then once the economic and social conditions were suitable, then came to prominence, as evidenced by the emergence of this whole class of wandering ascetics or Shramanas. And the Shramanas could have gained increasing adherence because of the economic and social upheavals taking place at this particular period in Indian history.
Were the Vedas ever memorized?
Oh, the Vedas were transmitted by memory for perhaps thousands of years. Yeah. Even now there are many of the Brahmins, the religiously trained Brahmins in India, know the Vedas by memory. I think it was only well into the Christian era, 500 AD or so, that the Vedas were written down. Yeah?
How long
can
you trace back
the
Brahmins? Can trace back?
The Brahmins,
date-wise. The Brahmins,
date-wise. Well, I think it's said that, conjectured that the Aryan, the people from the Central Asian plain, came into India about 2000 BC. And so they would probably had some kind of social stratification already with a Brahma, a class of Brahmins at the, dominating that social order. And so when they came into India and subdued the original inhabitants, the indigenous population, then they would have again continued to exert this dominating role in the society. They would have come as nomads, perhaps with weapons with which to have conquered the original inhabitants. I don't know any records of actual warfare taking place, but I mean, at this time there would have been no written records anyway. In fact, it's possible even that the Vedas preserve in somewhat mythological form accounts of the Brahminic conquest of the original population of India. Any further questions?
Where did the yogis or yoga
fit? Where did the yogis? Yeah. Yoga, well, of course, the original sense of yoga is not the practice of these rigorous physical exercises, but was a practice of a meditative or contemplative way of life aimed at liberation. And so the yogis, what we call the yogis today, would have been within the Shramana community. So not all the Shramanas were engaged in these contemplative, meditative religious practices. Some just wandered, subsisting on alms. Others engaged primarily in this self-mortification. Others developed philosophical systems, which they would then debate with their peers. And even the word yoga itself, the Buddha uses very frequently, though not in the sense of these physical exercises, but in the sense of spiritual practice, spiritual exertion. I mean, that's a somewhat different story, but from perhaps beginning about the first century of the Christian era, first, second century, or second century, Buddhist monks started to go to China and then to translate Buddhist monks from India and from Central Asia, I think more from Central Asia, would go to China, and once they attracted some support from either the king or from intellectuals of the period, then they started to translate Buddhist texts from Sanskrit or from Central Asian languages into Chinese. Would you say that's correct? Of course, the whole translation project would have taken... There are different waves of translations extending perhaps over 800 years or so. But by the time the Nikayas would have been, or the Agamas would have been translated, I think in a fairly early time, within the first few centuries of the Christian era. Okay, I think we should end.